I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Australians who have been monitoring the anti-Muslim sentiment of the country say there's been a noticeable rise in Islamophobia since the Paris attacks. A mosque in New South Wales city of Newcastle had a handwritten message of hate placed near the entrance. And the telecommunications company Optus said it removed advertising material written in Arabic from a shopping center because of threats were made about it from online and staff members. Lucy Carter has this report.
Optus's decision to ditch Arabic signage at a shopping centre at Casula in Sydney's west has disappointed Dr. Yasser Morsi from the International Centre for Muslim and Non-Muslim Understanding at the University of South Australia.
Firstly, Arabic is a language spoken by plenty of non-Muslims. And even if it is simply about Muslims, I think pandering to the type of anxiety that's out there only increases it and creates a standard where misinformation and ignorance about the source of the problem only perpetuates and increases. So I'm very disappointed in Optus, and it seems like a reaction, if not an overreaction.
Written in Arabic, the signs had directed customers to a local Optus store where they could be served in either English or Arabic. However, after a social media backlash, the telecommunications company chose to remove the posters. In a statement, a spokesperson said,
Optus remains committed to minimising and eliminating discrimination through our corporate culture, marketing activities, employment practices, and interactions with the community. However, following a threat to our store staff, we made the decision to remove some materials that were published in Arabic. The safety and security of our staff is paramount.
The president of the Islamophobia Register of Australia, Mariam Vassada, says Optus may not have had much of a choice.
I have been advised that there's been major security concerns in terms of the safety of their staff members, so I think that's a legitimate reason to have the posters removed. So I support that decision if that's the basis on which it's based.
She says the backlash against Optus for simply trying to offer multilingual customer service is baffling.
It is over the top, and it is extremely disappointing that some people, I suppose, have equated the attack, the horrific attacks in Paris, with that of an innocent poster that happens to be in Arabic. And we see so many organisations and companies who translate their advertisements into various languages depending on the areas in which they're published. So this is a completely normal thing.
The World Today has confirmed that a mosque at Newcastle in the New South Wales Hunter region had a handwritten message of hate taped to its entrance. The Gallipoli Mosque at Auburn in Sydney's west says it's had an increase in hate messages and phone calls. Mariam Vassada says there's been a noticeable rise in Islamophobic incidents since the weekend.
We have had reports of, rocks being thrown in cars, for example, in Melbourne, where a visibly Muslim family was driving. We've heard of sort of road rage incidents that have gone way too far. One incident that has been confirmed and reported to police, and the man is in the process of being charged, is in the Gold Coast. A French-born man who's originally from Melbourne but holidaying in the Gold Coast. It's alleged that he spat in the face of a 17-year-old man and allegedly grabbed the breast of a 25-year-old woman and said to them, we're going to bomb you, you bombed France and we're going to bomb you.
Dr. Yasser Morsi from the International Centre for Muslim and Non-Muslim Understanding says it's clear Islamophobia is on the rise in Australia.
The violence is escalating, property is being damaged. It doesn't surprise me that mosques are being attacked. It won't surprise me that certain Muslim figures will be targeted, character assassinated and so forth, and it won't surprise me if it turns physical on the street.
He says encouraging debate on the issue, but discouraging inflammatory rhetoric is what's needed in Australia right now.
Having spaces where conversations can happen and allowing as much as possible to be said, having conversations where we can challenge ugly ideas as opposed to continually repressing them.
The Islamophobia Register of Australia's Mariam Vassada agrees.
This is a time where we really need to put aside irresponsible commentary and just think about the consequences of our words and our actions, because, it's times like this when we are tested and social cohesion can either be strengthened or it can be destroyed. And the actions of those in positions of influence, particularly politicians and media commentators, play a huge role in damaging social cohesion, and that damage is long-term.
The Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull was in Manila in the Philippines for APEC, that's the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, which this year was dominated by terrorism. Mr. Turnbull will have a first chance to sit down with an official bilateral meeting with the United States President Barack Obama. The plan to intensify airstrikes in Iraq and Syria is likely to dominate the discussions. But given Australia is already the second largest contributor to the U.S.-led coalition, it is unlikely to be under pressure to step up the current commitment. David Mark speaks next to Samantha Hawley, who's in Manila.
Sam, this is the first bilateral meeting between our new Prime Minister and the US President, but obviously with added importance now because of the terrorist attacks in Paris. What is it thought that President Obama will be asking Malcolm Turnbull to do?
Well, David, certainly from what we're hearing from the Australian side here on the ground in Manila, Australia thinks its commitment to the fight against IS is about at the right level. Australia's the second largest contributor in the US-led coalition, with a commitment, I think, of about 800 defence members involved in things like training Iraqi soldiers and also, of course, the airstrikes in Syria. So it's unlikely Australia will move on those numbers by much, if at all, although they haven't officially ruled that out yet. But it's also unlikely that President Obama, during this meeting with Malcolm Turnbull, will put any large amount of pressure, I think, on Australia to really boost that commitment, given, as I said, that Australia is the second largest contributor already. That sort of pressure, I would think, Malcolm Turnbull will argue, and President Obama would agree, needs to actually be put on other nations like Britain, France, for instance. So I don't think there'll be any great pressure on Australia on that. I think more so they'll be talking probably about how better to do what they're already doing, so reviewing perhaps the frequency of airstrikes, whether they can be better targeted. There could be some discussion, for instance, of a change or a review of what Australia's doing rather than a serious boost in what Australia's already committed to. But, of course, President Obama is under a lot of pressure because the airstrikes have been going on for more than a year, and there are questions over whether they're really reaping the rewards or they're getting the results that they want. And I guess really key to these meetings that we're seeing, these leaders' meetings, the G20, and now the APEC summit here in Manila, is these world leaders coming together and trying to unite and come up with a better, more effective strategy to combat IS.
And against that backdrop, of course, all the talk is about whether there's a need to have troops on the ground. And just this morning, the former Prime Minister Tony Abbott called for Australia to possibly contribute special forces to a ground force in Syria. Have the leaders had to say anything about that possibility?
Well, certainly President Obama has had something to say about that already. He made some comments in Turkey before leaving to arrive here in Manila, and he certainly thinks it would be a great mistake to send in ground forces, so that is combat forces, into Syria to fight IS. He said it would be a mistake because it would require a very long commitment. You'd almost have to be permanently on the ground there. It would be too big a commitment, I think, is what he's saying. Obviously, Australia wouldn't send in combat troops either unless it came at a request of the United States, and that doesn't look like that will come. So basically, I think they've ruled that out. Of course, there may, though, David, be room for a military presence on the ground or a greater military presence, but it certainly wouldn't be for fighting. It wouldn't be combative, but it may be something that the leaders will discuss as well. And the leaders will make a statement straight after their bilateral meeting, so it will be interesting to see if they come to any conclusions, whether or not they come to any agreement and exactly what they have to say after that meeting.
Okay, well, obviously terrorism is the big ticket item at APEC, but it is one of the most important regional groupings in the world. What else is on the agenda?
Well, yes, because this is actually an economic forum, and of course terrorism is dominating, rightly so, because of the attacks in Paris. But there are other things going on. There are things that have been on the agenda that will remain on the agenda. The Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, for instance, there's a lot of onus on President Obama to reassure some of the nations that have signed up to this, including Australia, that the US Congress will pass the deal. Of course, there's been some domestic opposition for President Obama at home. Now, tensions over the South China China Sea. That's actually not on the official agenda. But interestingly, President Obama will visit a Philippines Navy ship while he's here, which will undoubtedly displease the Chinese president, who's also attending this summit. And I think climate change and the climate will be high on the agenda too. Again, President Obama wants to move towards a global climate pact, and that will certainly be discussed among these Pacific leaders while they're here in Manila.
ABC correspondent Samantha Hawley speaking with David Mark. The independent senator, Nick Xenophone, says leasing Darwin's port to a company connected with the Chinese army could compromise Australia's national interests. Last month, the Northern Territory government struck a $500 million deal with the Landbridge Group to lease the port of Darwin for 99 years. But a Canberra researcher subsequently uncovered the company's close links with the Chinese Communist Party and China's Red Army. Senator Xenophone wants a Senate inquiry to examine why defense officers and the secretary of the department said there was no security concerns with the deal. Louise Yaxley has the story.
In Darwin today, the Labor leader Bill Shorten said he has questions about the port deal.
We want to hear from our security and defence experts. Are there any implications in terms of our national security? I think what we need in this climate is just the facts on the table.
He says it's important to have all the facts about the sale of such strategic infrastructure. But Mr. Shorten isn't calling for the deal to be put on hold.
We need to see what are the circumstances and arrangements behind it before we start going to the next stage.
Bill Shorten says the nation relies on foreign investment and he's not opposed to it.
But then, of course, you've got to make sure that when you have foreign investment, that you're meeting a certain set of tests. You know, is it something which is against Australia's national security interests, for example?
Around a week after the Northern Territory government announced the deal with the Chinese company, questions were raised about it in Senate estimates. Dennis Richardson, who's Secretary of the Defence Department, played it down.
Senator, in respect of Darwin, Defence does not have any security concerns in respect of the sale of the port to Chinese interests. Our interest in a commercial port is access to the port and its facilities. And the deed of licence, which we signed in May of this year, provided us with the access that we wished in respect of the Port of Darwin. When we were subsequently advised that the sale was to Chinese interests, we examined the possible security implications of that. It involved within Defence the three services. It involved the Australian Signals Directorate. It involved the Defence Security Agency, and it involved the strategic policy area of Defence. And no part of Defence had a concern from a security perspective in respect to the sale.
Independent Jackie Lambie kept pushing, but she received the same answer.
I just want to know why it says in a previous Defence White Paper that when it comes to the Chinese, that they are a threat to Australia, yet we're now leasing or considering we're leasing and what's going to happen in the future, selling our ports to them. I don't understand how this is comfortable.
The two issues, the question about China's broader strategic posture in the region and what they might own in Australia in this, or what might lease in Australia and the security implications of that are really quite separate.
But the difference since that hearing is that it appears not to be just a Chinese company, but one linked closely to the Chinese army. The company, Landbridge, says that's based on a misunderstanding of Chinese text and it's been misconstrued. And it points to the Defence Agency's finding that there are no security concerns. But Senator Nick Xenophon says the information that's come to light since that Senate estimates hearing warrants a new inquiry.
It's critical that Defence is brought back to a Senate committee to explain what they knew of this deal at the time they said it was okay to go ahead, that they didn't have concerns. If they were aware of the involvement of the Chinese army in relation to this company that is controlling the Darwin port for the next 99 years, then we need Defence to explain why they wouldn't be concerned about that and the reasons for that. And if they weren't aware of it, then that brings into question the whole deal that was done and the process and the examination of the deal in the first place. This just needs to be scrutinised appropriately in terms of a clear and unambiguous national interest test. Let's put this in another way. If a foreign company with clear links to that country's military wanted to take control of a key Chinese port, I'm sure the Chinese government would laugh them out of the country, because there is no way that China or indeed Japan or a whole range of other countries in the region would even countenance such a deal. But it seems to me that here in Australia, we have a different standard, one that could arguably compromise the national interest.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The New Zealand government is rushing through laws to monitor convicted criminals due to be deported from Australia. The government says 20 of its citizens are leaving a detention centre on Christmas Island this week, joining hundreds who've been deported earlier last year under stricter Australian visa laws. Now they will essentially be on parole once they return to New Zealand. Bridget Brennan has the story.
The Australian government tightened visa laws almost a year ago. Since then, about 200 New Zealanders with serious criminal records have been deported. Some were found guilty of aggravated assault, rape and murder, but because they served jail time in Australia, New Zealand authorities haven't had the power to put them on parole. New Zealand's Justice Minister Amy Adams has introduced an urgent bill to her country's parliament to rectify that.
It is about making sure that someone who has been in an institution and under very strict rules for a long period of time is carefully monitored and watched for offending behaviours and for the assistance they will require as they reintegrate.
The New Zealand government is rushing the bill through its parliament because it says 20 detainees are due to be deported on a chartered flight from Australia to New Zealand later this week. But New Zealand Labor Party MP David Shearer says those supervision laws should have been introduced sooner.
On Thursday, Con Air arrives, a flight that is chartered by the Australians that is arriving here with 20 people who have just been released, and they will arrive here, and we hope that the legislation that is going through urgency here will be in place for the arrival of that plane. Now, sir, that is a disgrace when this government knew last year, on the 14th of December, that Australia had changed its laws. We are in a serious situation where the government has been telling us all along that they're standing up for our protections and our freedoms. They are certainly not. They're not standing up for us when it comes to New Zealanders coming back here with criminal convictions and no legislation and no procedures in place to receive them.
Many of the New Zealanders being deported no longer have family ties in their country of birth, so there are serious questions being asked in New Zealand about whether potentially dangerous convicted criminals will be able to reintegrate into a society they're unfamiliar with. New Zealand Labor Party MP David Parker.
Some of these people are getting back to New Zealand with no money, no ties, ending up sitting on the wind's doorstep the next morning because they've been delivered into the hands of New Zealand without any support being provided to them. And I would hope that as the government realises that this problem needs to be addressed, they also look at what they need to do to maximise the chance that they can be meaningfully reintegrated into our community in a way that means that they don't end up reoffending against other New Zealanders.
And the issue does appear to have put some strain on Tasman ties. New Zealand's Justice Minister Amy Adams again.
We are, as a close neighbour and for a long time close friend of Australia, found ourselves in the position when the impact on New Zealand was brought to my attention first in February of this year. What that meant was that New Zealand found itself starting from a completely cold start once the law was already in operation. That is not ideal. That is not the way that we expect to deal with Australia.
New Zealand's Prime Minister John Key says he'll be raising the issue of increased deportations with Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull this week at the APEC Leaders Summit in Manila.
In the last couple of months, Japan has undergone a historic shift. The interpretation of the country's pacifist constitution has changed, and for the first time since World War II, Japanese troops can now fight overseas. A record defense budget is set to be approved, and many in Japan believe the changes will lead to an increased tension and instability in the region. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has championed the muscling up of the military, and he's proving to be a decisive figure. Some see him as an ultra-nationalist who will lead Japan down the warpath once again, while others say he's just a realist, responding to the realities of a more aggressive China. North Asia correspondent Matthew Carney now looks at Japan's tilt to the right.
Takashi Uemura has felt the full force of the rising right in Japan. As an investigative reporter in the early 1990s, he was one of the first to uncover the systematic use of sex slaves or comfort women by the Japanese Imperial Army before and during World War II. And a quarter of a century on, the far right in Japan has branded him a traitor for tarnishing Japan's honour. There's also been threats of violence against his family. Takashi is married to a Korean woman.
My daughter's photograph appeared on the internet with a quote saying, "This girl's father is the reason why Japan is suffering." There were also comments like, "We need to force her into suicide." There was my daughter's photograph, her name, and many slanderous remarks for all to see.
The campaign against Takashi is part of a much wider attempt of the far right to whitewash Japan's war crimes, to try and erase the facts that 200,000 women, mainly from Korea, were used as sex slaves, or that massacres like the rape and pillage of Nanjing in 1937 never happened or were exaggerated. And the campaign has gone international. The Japanese government has demanded that a US publisher delete any reference to comfort women in their high school textbooks, and it's spending millions of dollars trying to counter any message from China and South Korea. Former Japanese Prime Minister Tomoichi Moriyama says Japan has to face up to history.
Past historical facts are not going to change. Fact is fact. The facts are there was colonization. There was aggression. That these were mistakes, we need to acknowledge these historical facts so that we don't repeat them.
Many believe the rewriting of Japan's wartime past is just one part of a right-wing agenda being driven by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to make Japan great again, to reform the constitution and bring back the power of the emperor and embolden the military. Professor Setsu Kobayashi from Tokyo University believes Shinzo Abe sees it as his destiny to do so.
His personality is like that of a king or prince. His family is from the establishment from the Meiji era, way before the constitution. His grandfather, Nobusuke Kishi, was responsible for World War II and was tried as an A-class war criminal. But somehow he escaped and ended up becoming prime minister. Kishi's dream was to revert to the Meiji constitution, and he said Japan did no wrong with the war. Mr. Abe says he learned on his grandfather's knee the meaning of making Japan great again.
Professor Kobayashi says the reinterpretation of the pacifist constitution in September is just the first step in Prime Minister Abe's plan to completely overhaul the constitution. Over the last couple of months, Japan has seen unprecedented public protests from people demanding no change to the constitution.
Democracy in Japan is unfortunately very low at the moment. This is what we have found out. We have a government that cannot be moved by the people, so the people need to take action to get it back. Then for the first time, we will learn about sovereignty of the people.
But many others say Prime Minister Abe is simply a realist and understands Japan has to take responsibility for its security after 70 years of American protection. Times have changed, and Japan has to face up to an increasingly assertive China. Investigative reporter and academic Takashi Uemura says he won't be bullied into silence by the rise of the right in Japan, and he's now taking his accusers to court on charges of defamation.
Writing articles and speaking out as a journalist means protecting freedom of speech.
So even though there's a lot of abuse, I will not flinch nor lose. I did not fabricate anything, so I am fighting and will continue to fight.
And finally, he was built like the biggest second rower and ran the fastest as the fleetest winger. The man who revolutionized international rugby union, the All Blacks great Yona Luma, has died unexpectedly at the age of 40. The New Zealander suffered a rare form of kidney disease, an illness that eventually claimed his life. Tributes this week were pouring in for the 6'5" winger who bust onto the international rugby state in the 1995 World Cup. Penny Timms reports.
On behalf of the Loma family, I can confirm that Jonah Luma died this morning, most probably about 8 or 9 o'clock this morning.
It was the news that shocked the world's rugby union family. An emotional former All Blacks doctor, John Mayhew, confirmed the news to New Zealand's TV3.
It was totally unexpected. Jonah and his family arrived back from United Kingdom last night and suddenly died this morning. I think it's obviously a very difficult time, because a great rugby player and a great person. It's a terrible tragedy.
Jonah Lomu burst onto the rugby scene in the early 90s, becoming the youngest All Blacks test player at just 19. He made his first test appearance in 1994. At 6'5" and 119 kilograms, he was an imposing figure. But it wasn't until the Rugby World Cup in 1995 that his star power was appreciated by the rest of the world.
Well, Wade to Lomu.
He scored 7 tries during the series. 4 of those were in the semi-final against England. It was that match that saw him become a human bulldozer, trampling over the top of a stunned England fullback, Mike Catt. Vision that impressed many and has since gone viral.
Also at the top, he's gone straight over 3 people. Rob Andrew couldn't stop him. Carling couldn't stop him.
Jonah Lomu made 63 test appearances for the All Blacks and was considered the sport's first global superstar. But illness was starting to take hold. In 1997, he announced he was suffering from a rare kidney disease. He continued to play on and off despite his illness and often spoke of his desire to stay in the game.
If I didn't think I could play well enough, I wouldn't try. But, the way I'm feeling... I feel good, I feel strong, I feel healthy, and I'm getting that real competitive edge of wanting to compete.
In 2004, he had a kidney transplant, but that kidney later failed him in 2011, and he was forced back onto dialysis as he waited for a donor. He died waiting for that new kidney. New Zealand Prime Minister John Key says he will be missed by the whole country.
He'll be remembered not only for being a truly amazing global sportsman and for his time on the field, and of course some of those incredible encounters that we saw in the 95 Rugby World Cup against England. He'll be remembered for his sportsmanship, someone that stayed on the field and shook the hands of the players when we lost the 95 Rugby World Cup.
Jonah Lomu was 40 years old.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International, the weekly edition of the program. There's a 3-time daily version that is broadcast to the Pacific. That is 15 minutes each. And we will make those available very soon at our website as well. If you want to contact us to let us know what you think of the program or have any comments or suggestions, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. A special thank you to ABC Radio National. I'm Keith Powell. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.